This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
What's up, peeps? He's back again to another quarterly co-host, Tom Geraghty, back for episode 2 to talk all about psychological safety.
The problem in safety isn't deviation, it's complexity.
Health and safety has gone mad.
Health and safety is trying to unpick having gone mad in the past.
There's no one solution and one problem. The problem is that we are looking for one solution.
Does the structure of the team allow them to flourish?
Feel safe enough to be uncomfortable.
The environment defines our behaviors.
People aren't the problem, they're the solution.
Rebranding safety, crushing the stereotype. Brought to you by RiskBlue.
What's up, peeps? Welcome back to Rebranding Safety. Rebranding Safety is the YouTube channel and podcast doing exactly what it says on the tin. So if you're new here, hit that subscribe button, bell, follow, whatever magical algorithm button is on your platform. My name is James McPherson, the MD and lead consultant here at RiskFluent, the company that brings you Rebranding Safety. So today we are episode 2 of our quarterly co-host. It's the first quarterly co-host of this year. If you are interested in being a quarterly co-host, you want to try something weird out, you want to talk about your methodology, you want to talk about a specific topic that may be pissing you off or exciting you or whatever it is, you can have 3 episodes with us. You come on, be a co-host. It could just be me and you, or we could co-interview someone, we could have group calls. It literally is an open book. So if you've got something you're passionate about, you want to talk about, you think, oh, one episode's not enough, then please DM me and we can sort you out with the next quarterly co-host. But as we stand, we are with Tom Geraghty at Q1 of 2023, and we're talking all about psychological safety. This is a great conversation. If you are unsure about taking all of these helicopter terms for psychological safety and applying it and really understanding it, this is the place to be. This is episode 2, but this is the one where we really get into what does this actually look like. Now, don't get me wrong, we don't go anywhere near how deep this can go, but we talk about so much stuff. And then episode 3, we're going to cover a hell of a lot more as well. So if you are thinking about looking into psychological safety, if you've maybe read the book, watched a couple of keynotes, or saw some blogs of these people that think they know psychological safety because maybe they read one book once or watched a TED talk, probably start here and then go into the source material if I was you. But before I get on my high horse, because let's be honest, no one wants to see me there, let's get on to our conversation with the amazing Tom Geraghty. Tom, welcome back to the podcast, mate.
It's great to be back. Thank you.
Just starting to realise how dark my screen is. Thank you very much for coming on again. Obviously, you didn't really have a choice. You committed to 3 episodes, so yeah. You had to come back on. But we had some good feedback off the first one already. So people are clearly interested in this topic, which we kind of knew anyway, but definitely vibing with what we're talking about. Can you remember what we spoke about? Are you comfortable giving a quick refresher on kind of what we spoke about?
I've got my notes here. I could go through my notes, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
We very much just kind of chewed the fat, really, didn't we, on like introducing the concept, where it came from, some key academics in that process as well. So I do think if people, you always get those weirdos. We used to have a friend that they said, I like Game of Thrones, but I don't really get it. And then we were like, oh, right, because they started at like season 5. They didn't watch 1 to 5. So if you are that weirdo that just thought, I'm just going to listen to episode 2 and not listen to episode 1, then, you know, it's your own fault. But go back to listen to episode 1. But yeah, we just really kind of introduced the concept, I felt. Whereas today, really want to kind of get into the nuts and bolts of what it is, kind of how it became and what it really looks like, I suppose. And then maybe hopefully get into some potential criticisms if we have time, as to some criticism. And then if we have even more time, which we might not, and this might go over to the episode 3, but how does it work with things like workers done, workers imagined, and so on?
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. It's really nice opportunity for me, at least, to really to dive into it a bit more and get into the, like you said, the nuts and bolts of it a bit more. It's really, really great opportunity.
There was definitely in my head, I was like, we need to do at least one episode of what this actually looks like, because I do think it's just one of the things we suffer with so much, maybe in society, but particularly in safety. It's just this addiction to like helicopter views on stuff. Like, just being like, oh yeah, like, and even the newer, more modern, more woke safety people are just as bad for it. Like, oh yeah, people are not the problem, they're the solution. Like, that's just the tagline. You want to probably look at all of this academia that sits underneath that tagline. And psychological safety maybe suffered from that as well, I think.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. But it's like a bit, like you say, it's like so much of the kind of work and business and leadership literature and stuff where it's, and of course, what's easy to consume and what's kind of almost more enjoyable to consume and kind of easier to create is the broader, and I want to say generic. I don't really mean that as an insult, but like, It's what's really difficult is to what's more difficult is to create the guidance, the tools, the practical advice that applies in the context of people actually doing the work.
Yeah,
and like, you know, I've got massive respect for Simon Sinek, and he's done some great work in it, and I love his books. And you read his book and you come away thinking, he's got it, he's nailed it, this is exactly what I want to do. And then you walk into, you know, a one-to-one with someone and like, right, okay, but what do I actually do now? What does that mean in practice? And it's there is this gap sometimes between the broad brush and the practice of it.
It's funny you use Simon as an example, because I love Simon's work, but I've got to a point now where I loathe Simon's work, because all I hear everywhere is, yeah, but what's your why? And I'm like, tell me what you mean by that, because I'm fed up of being asked what my why is when no one can really tell me what their fucking why is. And like, there is this real, like, the notion of it makes 100% sense. And I get it, and there's evidence to it, but like, the nuts and bones of what that actually looks like, particularly for an organization, even for an individual, I find it's phenomenally hard to work that out. But for an organization, like, what's your purpose? Like, I don't know, we fucking build these machines that my dad invented, like my great granddad invented, or whatever. It's phenomenally hard, and I think psychological safety is the same as that.
That's a really good point, actually, because I think it's actually really, really important. There's so much to unpack here, because it is really important to understand the why, partly just to exist as a business, as any organization, to do the thing you're trying to do, you need to know the why. You need to know your mission. You need to know what you're actually trying to achieve. The mission of our business is to make the world of work a safer, more equitable, and higher performing place. And actually, and so we've tried to create a mission that's quite clear and concise, and memorable, which means that when we're talking about some work, whether we should take on a client, whether we should do this work or do that work, we can just look at our mission statement and say, does it do some of that? Because if it doesn't, then we're not going to do it. And so it's really, really helpful for us to do that. And so much hangs off that mission statement, that why. But what I also find interesting is that, like you've just talked about, a business that makes, what is it, like widgets that your dad invented, and that's cool, like that's great, because I think we were talking about this before or earlier, where there's almost this sort of unwritten, unspoken shame in, well, we're trying to make a living.
This is like one of my biggest bugbears with this whole thing is like, oh, what's your why? Like, I've worked for a company that makes machines, and their why is like so far removed from what they actually do. I'm just like, huh? What? And why is nobody's why on their website? Because it fucking is inside their soul and their mind. Why has nobody got the cojones to write on there
What's the why of this business? To make a shitload of money.
Exactly.
Because I guarantee there is a lot of businesses out there that are about making a shitload of money.
Or like, you know, making the founder rich by exiting and selling off to Facebook or something. And that's...
all of a sudden, Simon's work is like, everyone's why has to be this like really ethical, like really socially moral kind of thing. Like Jeff Bezos's why is what, you know, make sure that every consumer gets their high quality product within an hour. Maybe it is, right? I don't think it is. I think it's about getting a shitload of money. Maybe at some point, I'm not sure. Maybe I'm being grumpy.
I think this is the thing. Like, you can have two missions, two whys. One is the why of the business, like, and that's like kind of whether you know the business is doing the right thing for the business, whether you're continuing on the right path, sort of thing. And yeah, your other is why for you, for the person who owns a business or works in a business. And we live in a capitalist world where, you know, someone invented money a long time ago. So we've got to keep making it, because that's the game we've been set.
Interestingly, because this has come up a couple of times now, not just with us, but in a different conversation, different quarterly co-host, we were talking about with another safety consultant that started his business pretty much just a couple of months before us. So we did a whole quarterly co-host just talking about running a safety consultancy and how kind of hard it is and so on. And we ended up talking about our why for a long time, and I went off on a very long rant about it. And I'm still struggling with it to that point. You mentioned something really interesting there about having multiple kind of purposes. But interesting, I don't know if you've ever been on the Ethics Centre website. And they've got loads of, it's an Australian-based organization, I think. But the Ethics Centre, they've got loads of really handy like guides and that, and their best practice guide to good culture, I think it's called, or best practice guide to culture, says each company needs to have an ethical framework. And in that ethical framework is basically a purpose, some values, and some principles. So the purpose is what you as a company exist for, obviously. Principles are guiding principles of like, we might say something like, we're a people-centered organization, something like that. It's a real broad but core guiding principle. And then your values are a little bit more tangible. So they might be, so if I look at our company, our values are, we don't do health and safety gone mad. We also don't do tick boxing, you know, so they're more tangible things, whereas our principles are kind of people-centered. So that's a principle for us. So that's core. But our purpose is to make smart businesses, not safe businesses. That's just us making up some stuff that sounds good. In my head, it's just like, it's a lot cruder than that, but it's kind of that's how we did it, and I've always followed that guidance because I thought it was really good.
How
does this contribute to psychological safety though?
So I think this is a really nice way in, because like psychological safety and clarity of purpose and everything around clarity of purpose are, to my mind, completely intertwined, in that a business, you've got your mission statement, you've got your values. So your mission statement tells you what you're trying to do. Values tell you kind of what the boundaries are, what the expectations are, how do we behave, how do we do this. Then you've got your strategy, of course, that describes how we're going to try to get to that mission, how we're actually going to steer our way there. And then you've got things like tactics and deliverables and stuff like that, which is all the short-term actual stuff that you do. Now, all of that is essential for psychological safety. If we turn up to work, if anyone turns up to work in any job wondering what they're meant to do that day, what on earth are we meant to do? Like, what's our purpose? Why am I here? Who am I meant to help? Who am I meant to serve? What am I meant to deliver or create? And how am I meant to do it? What are my boundaries of decision making? Like, where are the limits of the decisions I can make? You know, I presumably can make a decision to create a Word document and write a report, but presumably I can't make a decision to acquire this business over here for £24 million. That's probably outside of my remit.
Yeah.
But knowing where those boundaries lie and all of that stuff is really crucial for psychological safety. We don't have those boundaries. It erodes our psychological safety, our sense of security and predictability in our role. And this is psychological safety, but it's also about job role security and simply feeling safe in a job. But it is psychological safety because it affects how we communicate with each other. Like if we don't know what we're meant to be doing at work, if we don't know what our mission is, if we don't know what our boundaries are, it can make communicating with other people, particularly maybe more people with authority in our organization, quite difficult and concerning and worrying and anxiety ridden, because we're not quite sure if we're speaking above our station, out of place, if we're saying something we shouldn't say, if we're talking about something we shouldn't talk about, if we're saying something stupid or something like that. So knowing all this stuff, wrapping all this stuff up in something and making it explicit, so making your mission explicit, making your values explicit, making your strategy explicit, and then once we get into tactics, making all that explicit is really crucial. But once we get into tactics, this comes to Google's Project Aristotle stuff. So this is to high performing teams. This is in addition to psychological safety. We need people need to know that their work actually makes a difference. Like if you're going to write that report or write that bit of code or run a workshop or whatever it is you do, you need to know that that actually makes a difference to someone. There was a really interesting study a while back. I can't remember who did it, but there's a really interesting study done with people writing, like filling out forms in a big room. And they had lots of people filling out forms. And some of the people, so whenever you filled out a form, you take it to the person at the front desk, and depending on what group you were in, what sort of study group you were in, the person would either take your form and they'd read it and say, "Oh, thanks very much, that's brilliant," put it on a pile, and then give you another one to fill out. For another group, they'd briefly look at it, put it on a pile, and give you another one to fill out. For another group, they wouldn't even look at it; they'd just scrunch it up and throw it in a bin and give you another one to fill out. And it kind of sounds obvious, right? But even though these people were doing exactly the same work, they're being paid the same rate, they're doing exactly the same work, the people who were getting praised for it and knew that their work, or perceived that their work made a difference, performed at a much, much higher level than the people who saw their work get thrown straight in the bin. So you need to know that work makes a difference.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of things here. I really like that. I'm going to come back to that. I want to clarify clarity, ironically. So we need to have some clarity of what the business is ultimately trying to achieve. I need to have clarity of what in my task I'm trying to achieve, or my project or whatever it may be. And then also, do I need to have clarity of my role within that and my boundaries as well?
Exactly. And this is why, and that clarity is actually really hard to achieve, right? Because like clarity one, mission statement, like what are we here to do? So if you're in the NHS, for example, you know, you're here to save lives and improve the health of everyone who comes into contact with the organization, right? I don't actually know the mission statement of the NHS, but I assume that's it, something like that. So you know that. But yeah, and knowing what you're there to do, what your role in that is, and what your place in the team is absolutely crucial. And it does break down into these different components. And that's why the fact is that this is hard. And the fact that this is hard is why there are so many different frameworks out there for establishing clarity. Things like OKRs, objectives and key results, things like SMART objectives. And I'm struggling to think of others, but they're all acronyms. They're all basically different ways of turning that goal into, okay, but I've got a pen and paper or a hammer and nail. What am I going to do right now? And what am I going to do first? Almost more importantly, like how do I manage priorities? And that is surprisingly difficult once you get above a certain organizational scale. Right? Mm. This is why we see startups. I've worked in startups that have been sort of 20, 30, 40 people, and we scaled up really, really quickly. At a scale of 20, 30, 40 people, you're getting stuff done like, or you just fire in on all cylinders. You're just going all the time. There's very little communication friction, and everyone is really close to that goal, really visceral and right there.
Tangible, isn't it?
Tangible. But as you scale up, it gets much more difficult to see for people in the organization to see their role, their piece, how their impact, and this is the point, how their impact affects the outcome, affects the organization achieving its goal.
So, and make sure I don't forget that, because there's so much in this. I'm just like, the thing need to talk about. I've got a question about this, but then I just want to talk about this. So, there's one thing that keeps coming up on my mind is when we said about clarity of like my boundaries of my role, that in its own right is quite complex because if you think about like I'm a receptionist, my role naturally has boundaries of X, but then you might also, and so then naturally you might come into like the hierarchy conversation, which I do want to come back onto hierarchy and how that works a bit. But additionally, you might say, just to use the NHS example, right? You might then look at a surgeon and say, oh, because of the social hierarchy of like being a surgeon, but they're ultimately probably equally limited in their roles because they're very specialist.
Yeah.
So they're very focused. Actually, maybe a receptionist has less boundaries of what they can do and flexibility within their roles compared to a surgeon. But then you've got quality boundaries, safety boundaries. Mm. In the NHS, you're going to have like biological patient safety boundaries, then you're going to have data boundaries. So if you like, I'm just thinking, because I keep coming back to it from a safety point of view, in that we create boundaries and safety, like that's our kind of job in a way, isn't it? Risk assess and go, where's the boundary, where's the fail safe and so on. As an employee, I find that's really hard to work to remember all of these boundaries that you can't cross.
Yeah, and exactly. And this is kind of a, so I've see this as the kind of outcome of an overemphasis on safety one approaches, like trying to stop things going wrong. Whenever something goes wrong, we put in another boundary. That tends to be the practice, right? We restrict and constrict behavior until we're sort of trying to treat people as machines, because we're just trying to restrict their natural tendency to go outside those boundaries, which makes it even more difficult to understand where all these boundaries lie, because like you said, there's so many different kinds. There's like the receptionist, for example, might have a very broad remit but a quite shallow remit. They haven't got much power, maybe, but they've got a little bit of power in a lot of different places. That surgeon has a lot of power in one very, very small niche, and that's just on that operating table right there. They might have other more sort of social power and stuff as well, due to status and things. But I find the idea of boundaries really, really interesting as well when we're talking about sort of going back to psychological safety and human error and stuff, because human error, so there's a categorization of human error, which is slips and lapses, mistakes and violations, right? So slips and lapses are, you know, the things we forget to do or you know, maybe don't do it quite perfectly. Maybe we're driving, we go slightly above the speed limit because we were looking at something else. That's natural, right? It's illegal, but I think we've all done that, and most of us would consider ourselves good drivers. And then there's mistakes, which is making a decision that turns out to be wrong after the fact. Like we decide to pull out at a junction, but it turned out to be the wrong decision because something that we didn't realize or didn't see or couldn't see that there was a motorbike coming around the corner. And then there's violations, and it's violations that I find almost most interesting of the lot, because violations are where we intentionally, or well, where we go outside of those boundaries, where humans go outside of the boundaries, and we can go outside the boundaries intentionally or unintentionally. We might know about the boundary and just not care about it and just do what we want to do anyway. We might not even know about the boundary, and so we exceed the boundary because we didn't know it was there. We didn't know the speed limit was in place. We didn't know there was a speed limit, so we just traveled at whatever speed we wanted to. But this is where I find this deviation, this violation of boundaries really interesting, because in psychologically safe teams, where we've got really clear goals, really clear objectives, that's where we can violate these boundaries. We can deviate on purpose from these boundaries to do the right thing, to get the right thing done. And often that increases safety, because these are often edge cases. These are often cases that the policies and procedures didn't really anticipate. But in a psychologically safe team, if someone deviates on purpose, now I always love this phrase, deviate on purpose. If you're going to deviate, do it on purpose. If someone deviates on purpose from the policy, the procedure, the boundary, they will not be punished. It might turn out to be wrong, but we accept that they were trying to do the right thing, and they had the expertise, and in fact, they did everything. It's the local rationality principle, isn't it? It's people do reasonable things given their goals, knowledge, understanding of the situation, and the focus of attention at a particular moment. So they knew what the goal was. They had their knowledge. They can have no more knowledge. That's what they've got in their heads. They understand the situation. They may or may not have total understanding of the situation. And they've got a somewhat limited focus of attention. None of us can focus all of our attention on one thing at one time. And we may, because of that, decide to deviate and violate this boundary. And in some organizations, that's always punished.
Mm.
But in some organizations, if that deviation was on purpose, then it's a learning opportunity, because actually that deviation on purpose may well have saved someone's life or done something really good. And so, but it's only in retrospect that we can make that call.
Okay. So slip, slaps, mistake and violation I've kind of known for a very long time and always struggled with it, if I'm honest, because...
Mm.
The mistake is a wrong choice, as you kind of said, and a violation is I've always found them way too similar. Like they're all very much the same thing. Like a slips and laps, if we use the speeding example, right? If you're speeding, is that not also the wrong choice? You're choosing to speed, or is it a knowing choice? And then additionally, when we get into this conversation of like blame, accountability, is a purposeful deviation, and I was trying to get the job done.
So
it's just like, well, we've never done it like that. And there's all this, I feel like this becomes a huge conversation about when do we blame, when do we blame, when, and it's this.
Well, so this is brilliant. I love this because the first thing is that I don't feel it's ever useful to blame in any of these situations. Right, slips and lapses happen to us all. However much expertise we have, Mozart made mistakes. Mozart slipped and lapsed sometimes when he was playing piano.
Yeah,
we all make slips and lapses. That's natural. We're biological beings.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't blame slips and lapses. That's just nature. Yeah. Mistakes. The way I frame mistakes is so if you're driving along and you come to a T junction and you can go left or you can go right. Now, you know that the place you want to get to is direction, like it's ahead of you. You don't have a map in front of you. You don't know whether the best route to go is left or right. So you just have to take a punt. You go left. Turns out that takes you on a 2-hour detour and you should have gone right. You had no way of knowing that. Same as a footballer taking a goalkeeper trying to save a penalty. They don't know in advance. They're just going to dive left or right or stay in the middle.
Okay.
That's a mistake, because you only knew in retrospect. There was no way of knowing which the best decision was in advance.
Okay, yeah.
Where's the violation, that's it. So the violation is where there is a policy, and so I think I've written about this in the past. So a nurse, say there's a policy that a nurse is not allowed to take bloods from a patient without the explicit instruction from a doctor. And so that's the policy. Nurses can't or shouldn't just take bloods from a patient to take blood samples. However, a situation arises where a patient comes in. The nurse believes there is clear need to get bloods as quick as we can. Maybe they suspect poisoning or something like that. So, but we know the doctor is 10 minutes away, 15 minutes away, half an hour away. So the nurse decides to take bloods anyway, because the patient's life is at risk, and taking the bloods and finding out quick could mean the difference between life and death. Now, she violated the policy. The nurse violated the policy.
And if they survive, she's a hero. If they die, she's punished.
Exactly. So if the patient survives, everyone goes, good decision, really well done, really, really good work there. Someone might be sitting there going, oh, but you shouldn't really have done that. But most people would say, well done. If the patient dies, then yeah, probably lose their job. So that's a violation. But again, you only, like, because policies and things are usually written for broad brush applications.
This is where I find this whole conversation from, it's kind of what I like to call academia as imagined and academia as done. Yeah. In the, I just find that, like, that you cannot avoid the conversation of, I'm gonna avoid the word, using the word blame, because I like to think of blame as like an emotional reaction.
Yeah.
But when I'll say culpability for now, because that's what I mean by this, is HR saying you're negligent, or safety putting the non-compliance through, or whatever. Mm-hmm. There is some form of punishment because you've become culpable for that mistake, which ultimately ties to accountability. If we were to use that scenario of the nurse is making a decision, a purposeful violation of that rule, it's a decision that I should be accountable for. I'm taking the bloods, even though I know I'm violating that rule. Okay, fine. In that moment, you're choosing to be accountable for it. That accountability only becomes culpability based on the outcome of the event.
Yeah.
So I had the really interesting scenario where somebody threw a line at me that proper caught me, and I was like, like pondering on it for a good couple of days. Like, sometimes we're not punishing people for the violation of a rule. We're punishing people for an injury by using the violation of a rule as an excuse, because we never punish the violation of the rule prior to the injury.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, and that's a really good point, because there may well have been hundreds or thousands of occurrences where people violated this rule in the past, before this adverse event, but it's the adverse event we find out about, and this is the opposite of Murphy's law, isn't it? Like, Murphy's law states what can go wrong will go wrong, but in fact it's wrong, because what can go wrong rarely goes wrong. Like, what can go right nearly goes right nearly all the time. Otherwise, everything would fall apart all the time. But we only notice it when it goes wrong.
So
if there's been 1,000 violations, and then on the 1,000th and one time it resulted in a bad outcome, then we punish it. That doesn't seem fair, does it? That doesn't seem right, because not only is it unfair, but we're going to have an adverse outcome on the organization, because everyone who sees that, who witnesses that, are now going to change their behavior. So all those violations are going to stop.
But here's how I try to approach this. So I'm a practitioner. I am definitely not an academic, right? So I struggle with a lot of this stuff. And one of, I think what we do as a company is try and take a lot of this stuff and work out, what does this mean for the guy building the roof over here, who's a team of five in his business and now has got Rich Fluen as his consultant, for example, right? And I'm coming along and I'm like, right, so we've got a difference between slips and laps and mistakes and violation. And he goes to me, I just need some fucking rams, James, because I need to get on site, get this job done. Right. Yeah. That's the big difference between in the Conklins, the Deckers, and the Amy Edmondsons are talking to your big aviation companies, your big oil and gas companies. And then it may be even trickling down to big construction companies. You know, like Langer Rourke are always kind of held as the pillars of kind of a lot of this stuff. But ultimately, that filters all the way down. That doesn't filter down to these small companies. And here's how I kind of try to communicate out. And this is taken essentially from a combination of Snowden's work, Carsten Busch's work, and James Clear's work, which is really a strange combination. So if you read Atomic Habits by James Clear, he says that kind of every action that you do is kind of a vote to it becoming a habit, right? So the more you do it, eventually that becomes you as a person. That becomes your habit. And then Snowden says that, Snowden and Carsten pretty much say the same thing, that a culture of an organization is a collection of interactions over time. So combination of both of their works, they pretty much say the same thing. So when I get into this minefield of blame and psychological safety, I kind of talk about it from a trade-offs point of view. So culpability / accountability is a trade-off to psychological safety and people telling you I've made an error. So that is, which ultimately contributes to learning. So if you were to say learning is a trade-off for culpability. So if you're going to blame someone, you realize that that's a vote towards blame. If you have too many votes towards blame, you skip the tails, you tip the scales, and you now are going to have really low learning levels. But the reason I kind of talk about it in trade-offs is because I'm not saying you can never, ever hold somebody accountable and ultimately issue a disciplinary in a process. I'm not saying that as a company, you can never do that. What I'm saying is understand that the more you do it, the less psychological safety there is in an organization, the more psychological safe, encouraging interactions, so to speak, you have, will increase it and so on. Does that kind of make sense? That's how
totally.
Apply it in reality. Does that work? Or
yeah, I think it does. And like, you know, we do have to hold ourselves. We do have to hold each other and ourselves accountable to accountable to high standards of performance, high standards of work. We can give ourselves and people some time and space, or you know, some allowance for, you know, or maybe we're tired, we're sick, we've just had a baby, we're going through some stuff. Like we need to recognize that human performance and human ability to deliver at a certain level is going to change through our day, through our week, through our lives, etc., etc. So we simply cannot perform at, you know, this standard all the time. However, that aspiration we should try and get there.
Yeah.
I do believe that nobody comes to work to do a bad job. Mm-hmm. We all want to do a good job. We want to feel at the end of the day like we did a good job, we did a good thing, we made a difference. We all feel better doing that. But sometimes there are cases where people are not trying to do a good job. And there's all sorts of complex reasons why that might be the case. There's social pressures, there's other stuff going on, maybe they're completely disillusioned with their job and the business they're in. There's all sorts of reasons we could dive into. Or there's competency issues, right? There's essential competency. And I've sacked people in the past for repeated violations of a policy that resulted in, or could have resulted in, serious incidents.
Yeah.
But that was only after many conversations.
Mm.
It wasn't like the first time. And it was only after many, many conversations about how to do this, what to do, why to do it, et cetera, et cetera. And it happens. We're all
looking at you trying to navigate this minefield.
It is a minefield. And there is no real clear. This is why it's so difficult, because there's no clear, for us as sort of managers or leaders or people running a business, there is no clear, this is the point where you need to punish. And by punish, I mean someone loses their job or gets some sort of other
disciplinary or whatever. Yeah.
If we were to work completely without consequence for inappropriate behavior, well, that's a route to poor performance, but it's also actually, weirdly, it's also a route to low psychological safety.
Mm.
Because it is that team culture of understanding and knowing that we are all trying to hold ourselves to high standards. We all hold ourselves to high standards of behavior, including like the quality of work we do, and as well as the quality of the interactions that we have with each other. And I think this is, we might get into banter in a minute. And
yeah, we're very close. Sorry, go on, carry on.
Yeah. But that's what helps to foster psychological safety, because it helps to set those expectations of the team, and it helps us all on the team to know that other people on the team are going to treat us with respect and high standards of interpersonal behavior.
So I think this flows really nicely into motivation. Because I think it would be very, very demotivating to work in a place where the boundaries and constraints are so tight that we can't achieve what we want to do or what we need to do or what we're supposed to do. And then additionally, if there are no constraints and it's a no blame organization, and you get a couple of people who just kind of take the piss out of that, and they do a lot less work and low quality work, but you're having to work harder to compensate for that because you care about your job, which happens all the time, right? I've been in organizations where I've had to slog it because someone else isn't. And it's their context to why they're not working hard. Mm. Yeah, there probably is. But me as their colleague, one, doesn't give a shit. And two, I don't care about their context because I'm having to do all the freaking work that they're not doing. So it becomes this real emotional kind of conversation. So really, it's a real hard thing for this a company to achieve, in that too many rules and constraints and rigid processes is potentially going to chip away at my motivation, I think. And then too loose of it, just a hire and fire them kind of way of walking, doing whatever, wild west of work, so to speak.
Yeah,
it's going to be demotivating as well.
Yeah, and probably the worst of the two is where you do have rules and procedures and boundaries and values and stuff like that, but no one is held to them.
I think is safety in a nutshell.
Yeah, and they're just the things on the wall. And
yeah. In a normal work environment, maybe in higher risk environments less so, but in normal work, which is what we call most of our customers, normal work, like manufacturing, construction, not high hazard industries, the amount of rules that are on your rams, but your rams are not even used to blow your nose. It's completely pointless. And that just becomes exhausting and demotivating for everyone. There's so much in this. How does motivation work within, we've kind of touched on it. I think you kind of said clarity of contribution, which for me felt like, well, I think I wrote that in my notes as kind of what you said. I've got clarity of how I'm contributing to the work. For me, that felt very similar to motivation, as how I would describe it. It also felt, not just this point, but another point you mentioned a minute ago, a lot of this stuff feels real close to Daniel Pink's work on flow and I can't remember how else you kind of said it, but feeling like it's getting an enjoyment out of it and being in that state of flow in a way.
So Dan Pink, drive. So there's the drive, this autonomy, mastery, and purpose, which I think is really, really nice way of putting it, because autonomy, mastery, and purpose can kind of combine from the ability. So autonomy is the ability or the agency to decide how I'm going to do the work. Mastery is the expertise. I'm actually capable and I'm capable of doing the work to a high standard. And purpose means like we have something we're trying to achieve. We feel that we're making a difference and we want to make a difference. And this comes back to Google's Project Aristotle stuff where they talk about meaning. So people need to care about what they do. Like, you can do a good job if you don't care about it. You'll reach a certain standard. If you're doing something just to take a paycheck at the end of the day, fine, great. Yeah, and you can do a good job. But to reach really high performance, people need to really, really care about what they're doing and really need to be invested in the outcome. And that's where we start to address this idea of motivation. And the flow thing is really interesting as well. This is, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, I think is how you pronounce his name.
That was, even if that is wrong, that was impressive.
Say it confidently and everyone believes you. And so this idea of the sort of the level of challenge and the level of difficulty and stuff like that, where we want to sort of fit in that perfect zone of challenge, where we feel like we can do the work, but it's hard enough to keep us interested, and that's the idea of flow. And we all sort of, I think most of us can empathize with this idea of flow, whether we're, I sometimes equate it to mountain biking or motor car racing or software, like whatever you're doing, you get in the zone, you get in the flow zone,
I think that stuff works really, really well. Interestingly, we did a whole book club around Daniel H. Pink's book. We used to run a book club through the Health and Safety Network. Mm. And Daniel H. Pink's book, Drive, was one of our earliest books. And it was really, I remember it being quite a busy call. And I do remember a couple of people, which I find really interesting. We started off this conversation of how easy it is for people to kind of misinterpret a message from an academic or some amazing work like Daniel and Amy's work, in that a couple of people in that book club, but also since I've had outside of the book club conversation where people were like, oh, I've read his work and, you know, people just don't value money. I'm like, no, that's not what it says. it says you still need a fair salary to like live. I still need to feed myself and feed my family. But ultimately, beyond that, to get to the next level. But actually, I think this is where it does get quite interesting. In typically the jobs where I find flow is really hard to get to, because it's monotonous work, it's maybe like simple manual labor. So I'm thinking like in a warehouse, like you kind of said, if you're that kind of person that just wants to start at a time, finish at a time, go to work, do a relatively simple job, that's cool and that's sound. I think when we talk about flow, we all automatically go to like sports or complex work because it's really easy to talk about it and it makes sense. But monotonous types of simple, so the job is quite simple, but some people like doing it. Flow is really hard to maybe potentially achieve. I'm not sure. It feels like it would be. Secondly, they're also normally not paid great, these roles. And then also, like, not really considered very nicely by the company in a lot of these in these roles. And I just find like those types of like big organizations where ultimately you might have a laborer on a construction site who's got low flow, low salary maybe, and ultimately low motivation. And then we add in the fact that they might also have this low social hierarchy within the gang of builders and all of this stuff, which boom brings me to banter. And then we get banter on the top of that. And you're just like, this is such a complex social, if we just use the analogy of like a building gang where you've got a labourer, a brickie, or a couple of brickies maybe, and this labourer now, not getting flow, not getting good pay, and now he's getting the shit ripped into him by all of these brickies as well.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. There are lots and lots of jobs out there, maybe even most jobs out there, that that are just a recipe for dysfunctional culture, or a recipe for dysfunction. Because, like you say, people aren't paid enough, so they feel disgruntled at the work. They feel like they're being taken advantage of, and they're constantly worrying about money. So if you're constantly worrying about money, you can't really focus on the job. You can't get that flow, because part of your brain is thinking, how am I going to pay the bills? How am I going to pay my rent? And and I've been in that situation. It's horrible. You can't focus on your job.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you're not able to get into a flow because the work you're doing, maybe it's monotonous, maybe it's not very highly skilled, maybe it's not something you enjoy. Maybe it's physical, maybe it's hard physical work as well. I spent an entire winter hammering fence poles into frozen ground through the winter. That I didn't have flow in that. I couldn't feel my feet.
Yeah. I didn't even have blood flow.
I didn't even have blood flow, let alone like mental flow. And so you've just got this recipe for dysfunction. And this is where I think sometimes it's quite challenging, because we can talk about psychological safety, we can talk about safety cultures and stuff like that, but there are, you know, there's so much against us, and it feels almost sometimes I recognize that it can feel a little bit of a luxury to talk about psychological safety at work. And I think this is sometimes where we sort of get this detraction from some folks, where it's just like, we'll just get on with your job, you're being paid, but we can get into another one. But the banter thing, I think, is really interesting, because banter is so tricky, because it kind of comes back to the whole social contract. What's banter to one person is incredibly offensive and harmful, or could be incredibly offensive and harmful to another. And in fact, a lot of the time you wouldn't even know, because say you've got a group of five people, there might be a whole group of five people engaging in banter and what we call, so banter, you know, might be like taking a piss out of someone for how they look or how they sound or where they're from or something like that. And everyone, you know, maybe one person one or two people in the group feels like, this is all good. This is a good laugh. This is fun. We're having a good time. Maybe one, two, three, or maybe all of them, apart from one, are thinking, this is horrible. I'm not really not enjoying this, but I'm going along with it, because I don't feel safe to say, folks, this is really horrible.
Banter is kind of like a social violation. It's a purposeful breaking of a rule, e.g., it's kind of socially known you shouldn't mock people, you shouldn't belittle people, you shouldn't call people names, you shouldn't kind of pick out their faults and make them public to everyone else. But we do it in the name of banter. And you're right, in some environments it's very well accepted. I'm quite a banterful person. I just enjoy having a good laugh, and I'm quite comfortable with people throwing shit at me, and I find 90% of the time that I find that more funny than anything else. But I think about a couple of examples. So I go to like a business networking group, and we're known as like the banter group in the county, right? Because people just gravitate to it that get it. But when people come from the other groups to cover for people that can't come from our group, they just don't like it and they don't get it. And it does make me reflect on it several times, in that there's one lady in the group that's she's not even that old, if I'm honest, but like there's just this ongoing joke that she's really old. And that if any reference comes up about like King Charles, King Charles is real, but like King Edward, for example, we'd be like, oh, you know him, don't you? Like the joke, But it doesn't take much for someone to come into the room and find that really offensive. And we've been in situations like that, which brings us all the way back to what we were talking about earlier. It's a purposeful deviation. We're taking a risk, and we could have to be held accountable for upsetting someone for that. It's a really fine line.
Yeah, and one of the problems with like banter and this sort of almost laissez-faire attitude to sort of what things we all engage in banter to varying degrees in groups of different sizes and whatever. But one of the problems with it is that you don't, it's kind of hard to know who's listening, if you know what I mean, like who's seeing that. And so for
how,
for example,
yeah.
So say again,
and how are they seeing it? So
yeah, how are they seeing it?
Who's hearing it and how are they hearing it,
yeah,
in a way, isn't it? Yeah.
Exactly. So someone observing this group, someone who's new to the room and sees this group, bit of banter, taking a mick out of someone for being old, and they might see that and think, that's really horrible. I don't want to be anywhere near that group because I don't want to be subject to that same sort of ridicule. I'm really conscious about my hair or something. So if I go anywhere near that group, they're going to take the piss out of me for my hair. So I'm not going to go near that group. I don't feel safe in that group. Even though everyone in that group feels safe, but just one observer, because they don't have the context, they don't have the background, they don't have that deep interpersonal knowledge of that group, it looks unsafe, or it can make someone else feel unsafe in it. And then we get into sort of other tricky topics like, I don't know. Well, no, I think it's the same thing. I think it's the same thing. I think, yeah.
The one thing I kind of think of in that if you're in, I don't think this is just for a banterful group, but it is a banterful group. Is that even a phrase? But a group that's full of banter. Mm. For that kind of real banterful style of group, this is just a really good example. I always kind of say, like when I'm talking to people, I say, look, someone's got to go first. I think I might have mentioned this in the last podcast, I'm not sure, but someone's always got to go first. So the buffet's got to, someone's got to be the first person to the buffet, whether you like it or not, right? So you might as well just go first because, yes, you might be the first person. Yes, there's a risk that you go up and then someone goes, the buffet's not open, right? But ultimately, that same rule applies with banter in that if you're a banterful group, I actually think the group has to go first in making that person feel comfortable. It's not on that person to fit in. They might not fit in anyway, and they'll know that. But I think it's on the group to make them comfortable pretty quick. I've got to go. So if I know that my networking group is quite a bantful group, right? So if we get someone come in, it's on us as a group to kind of get in on that person, make them feel comfortable, get a gauge of that person as to trying to work out, are they up for the banter or not? And I think it's on, the onus is on us to do something. So from the point of view of a workplace team, if you've kind of got an apprentice who's normally the butt of the banter, times out of 10, I think it's on the onus of the team to work out if that apprentice can take the banter, because if they can't, it's a risk to you as a team, particularly in higher risk environments where that person could pose a risk to someone else.
Well, yeah, and I think this is kind of the crux of it, isn't it? Because there's two aspects. One is the fundamental respect for each other as a human being, and we should have that innate respect for everyone as a complete human being, whoever they are. And you know, I think back to when I was at school and banter was calling each other gay and saying, oh, did you bring your boyfriend? Like, and that's like, that was a long time ago, fortunately.
Sorry, I want to interrupt you because funny you should say that. I was listening to a Joe Rogan podcast because I quite like my MMA. So I was watching this kind of podcast of Joe Rogan, and it was a group of him and his mates were doing this thing. And they kept using gay as a derogative term. And it made me feel really uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And it actually made me really reflect on it, in that I would very comfortably, not so long ago, maybe about, I don't know, 5 to 10 years ago, I would be quite comfortable going, all right, mate, gay, you know, and that was this big thing that went viral. But now I was sitting on the train only yesterday, and these guys are, oh, that's a bit gay, isn't it? And I'm like, oh, I'm not sure that I feel uncomfortable hearing that. And I was actually surprised that I felt uncomfortable by it.
Yeah. Yeah, which reflects really well, because and is a is a sign of how far we've come, how far we've progressed in a short period of time. And we still have loads to deal with. And the fact that this still happens is a real problem. But the problem is that in some groups that's just considered banter.
Mm.
But what happens when, what happens when someone who is gay joins that group?
Yeah.
Or, of course, what might well be the case is that someone in that group is gay and they just feel so unsafe in even saying, by the way, I actually do have a boyfriend.
It's so interesting.
And so there's this fundamental respect for each other as human beings that we really have to get down to. Of course, from a business and safety perspective, if someone doesn't feel safe to even be themselves at work, to even, to be their essential fundamental self, because they're afraid of the banter and what people might say and what people might think, well, that's immediately pushing down and squashing their ability to point out other concerns, other things, like, say, someone in that group, I don't know, erected some scaffolding and just didn't, it looks a bit shonky. This person who already feels like a bit of an outsider, already feels a bit threatened, already feels a bit interpersonally unsafe, point out this problem, they're going to go up that scaffolding.
And actually, we've come across this in a team. Somebody was kind of essentially wearing PPE wrong, and it was a point of banter. And I was kind of part of this conversation afterwards. So after the fact, it came up in conversation. I kept coming back to it, and I'm not sure if they still got the point. I'm not sure I got my point across as well as I'd like to. But ultimately, they were kind of mocking this new member of the team for not getting it right. Whereas I was coming at this and being like, why didn't the rest of the team notice it? So essentially this person went like a good length of time wearing this PPE completely incorrect in that it would be doing nothing basically. Mm. And they were like, oh, you're an idiot. How did you not know? I'm like, there was just six of you other people around him at the time and not one of you noticed that. Like, and now what is the next knock-on effect of that if he comes to another piece of PPE or another piece of equipment or sees something else that he's not quite sure if that's right or wrong? He's not going to ask now because I guarantee he's not, because I've been there. I have been that guy and I still am in some scenarios. I still am the person that's just like, well, I'm not sure if this is the right train or I'm not sure if this is the right turning. Shall I ask someone? No, I won't. No. And imagine if I've had evidence-based history of getting the shit ripped into me for asking that, I'm most definitely not going to say something now.
Exactly.
I personally find this really difficult to deal with because I personally quite enjoy banter and I personally quite enjoy throwing out the banter, but then I also see the risk of it. And I've got a question for you, Tom. Randomly, I'm going to put you on the spot. Is banter just something that's wrong and should be wrong, but we're just so used to it that it's kind of socially acceptable?
I think it's almost impossible to say, but I think banter is like banter's on a spectrum, right? Like there's banter and there's banter. Like there's ripping it out of your, like, say you've got a mate who really really likes watching Love Island.
I have. Right. So I ripped the shit into him at 4 a.m.
Yeah. So like if you know each other really well and that's almost certainly in most cases that's absolutely fine. Then there's banter where we're calling people gay and things like that. Now one fairly easy to sort of determine piece is that on this end of the spectrum, that's a protected characteristic. That's something about who someone is that they can't change. And so, if banter is criticizing or addressing stuff like that, that's just not cool. That's
Okay.
It's verging on hate speech. Like it's verging on actual crime to a degree. Like if you shouted that at someone across the street, that's a crime. If you shouted at oh, you like Love Island at someone across the street, that's probably not a crime.
I like how you've drawn a distinction there. I think that's quite good. I think that's quite good actually. I'm conscious we're talking for a while, and there's a couple of bits I want to get into. But interestingly, just as a kind of, if I was a fly on the wall of this interaction, when I first joined the networking group, not everyone knew that I was hard of hearing and wear a hearing aid. Right. Some people did. But a couple of people didn't. And someone said something and I said, sorry. And they said something again. And I went, what did you say? And then someone else, because it's a bannerful group, said like, he said, blah, blah, deaf boy. And the whole room, because I was really new to the group, the whole room went, like, because I had no idea how I was going to take it.
Mm.
He had no idea that I was actually deaf or hard of hearing. It's a technical term. He had no idea, right? He just thought it's a funny joke because I've asked her to repeat herself three times in a row. Yes. So he kind of said this. And then after the meeting, I didn't think anything of it, mate. Not one, didn't even come in my brain. I was like, oh, that's funny because I'm actually deaf. That's even funnier. Eating my breakfast, making a bacon sandwich, comes over to me. He's like, James, really, really sorry. I did not know that you were actually deaf. I'm really, really sorry. And I was like, hey, fine, whatever. I probably felt more uncomfortable with the apology than I did the actual. But I thought that was really interesting. I got fly on the wall, like with the context, he in his head was like, that's not acceptable. Without the context, that is acceptable, which again comes back to what we're talking about. Everything is kind of outcome based, isn't it?
Yeah. And in fact, that's a really good point, because I think the most psychologically safe teams, the best performing teams will feel safe to call each other out and say, oh, mate, that's not like, you know, you might be a banterful group, but a good psychologically safe group with good boundaries, with ethical standards of behavior will feel safe to say, oh no, dude, that's a bit too far, mate. You've taken that a bit too far.
So I'm so happy you mentioned that, because I was trying to work out in my head, how do I get to this point? Because that I think is one of the other misconceptions of psychological safety that I want to kind of bring up, in that I think everybody thinks that it's like, oh, Tom, you're so lovely, and never actually giving you any critical feedback. Yeah. And I think that's a complete misinterpretation. Actually, I think it's the opposite. And it annoys me how people don't get this, because I think Amy herself, let alone everyone else who talks about it, I think Amy is really clear on this.
Yeah.
Actually, psychologically safe teams would be seen to kind of like bicker a lot more than any other group, because they're saying, no, Tom, sorry, that's not acceptable. And you're going, oh, no, actually, I think it is acceptable. I mean, you're going to debate that in a way, which might outside in look like we're bickering. We're not. We're assessing the new boundary in a way, aren't we?
Yeah, completely. And it's, I think I'm going to phrase this wrongly, but psychological safety is the comfort in being uncomfortable. It's the comfort in being able to challenge and be challenged in order to raise our standards. And they might be standards of behavior, like communication and banter, or they might be standards of workmanship or standards of quality or whatever it is. But that's, and like you say, psychological safety doesn't mean whatever goes, like anything goes. It doesn't mean that people feel safe to say whatever the hell they want. It means people feel safe to say something if they're not sure, and someone else will say, actually, no, that's or a better way to say that would be this. Like I remember when I worked back at the arena, and when I joined this big concert venue, the language around wheelchair users was disabled people, right? And then we moved into wheelchair users, or people who use wheelchairs, and And we, you know, we felt safe in having that conversation about, oh, that's, we acknowledge that that's an outdated term that might cause offence, so we're using this new term.
Yeah. And again, this comes back to, I think, as well, accountability. There's accountability on both sides. So that scenario of me being called deaf boy, there's an accountability on me. Let's say I wasn't comfortable with it. Let's say I was really upset, right? I think it's an onus on me, because he doesn't know me, it's an onus on me to not react and just say, I appreciate that you didn't know me, Tom, when you said that. But I'm just letting you know that going forward, I don't find that acceptable. It made me feel a bit uncomfortable. But look, I'm cool. You know, we're cool. Let's grab a bacon sarnie or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, but actually what we see, and I think we're seeing this in the evolution of our language with, as we're trying to, as a society, we're trying to tackle things like genders and all of this stuff. Like, and the reaction from some people are the recipient of someone getting it wrong. They turn around, you just do this, and you're completely negating where we need to get to. That person needs to learn boundaries. They're not going to learn boundaries by getting absolutely rollicked by.
Exactly. And actually, your example of being called deaf boy is a really good one, because yes, in an ideal world, in a psychologically safe team, you would feel safe, and that high degree of standard on the team would mean that you are beholden to say, actually, that's not cool. Use this different language or something like that. Even better would be other people in the team recognize immediately.
Yeah,
and you don't even have to say anything. Someone else just says, "Oh no, dude, that's not."
Which, to be fair, my group did do.
Well, yes, yeah.
They all went to him. Like, a few of them went to him afterwards and said, "Look, just to let you know, he is deaf," which then created an effect. So, in a way, just reflecting on it now, I've never really thought of it like this. It's just, I'm kind of thinking out loud here. I think we're quite a psychologically safe group in a way.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we also need to be conscious that so say someone who's trans, for example, might spend an awful lot of their time telling people what their pronouns are, correcting people on what their gender is or how they identify, and just dealing with all that shit that they have to deal with.
Now,
So we should be careful not to put the onus on them, the responsibility on them to sort of teach the rest of the group how to behave. Like, ideally, yeah, they would feel safe to say, you know, my pronouns are they, them, I identify as non-binary and blah, 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 blah. Ideally. But chances are they're probably sick of this. And they could do with some help, frankly. They could do some help in working with the group and telling the group what so other people in the group can take on that role for them and support them.
Well, it's interesting the example of kind of when we talk about someone's got to go first, and we're in the context of with a customer and a client, we typically say someone's got to go first, and in an organization, it needs to be power first, and power is the business, e.g. the majority. So in your context, the majority should go, how do you want me to refer to you or something like that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Then I do think there also needs to be the other side, like, so the employee side also need to take some accountability on how they, so it's like there needs to be accountability both sides.
Yeah,
I think fundamentally people don't understand psychological safety, and that it is exactly, you hit it on the nail on the head. It's being comfortable to be uncomfortable, which we had, I really would like, I might send you the link, but not to kind of push my own podcast onto you. But we had, I think I mentioned this on the last episode, a lady called Dr. Dara Blumenthal, who came on the podcast, and she said that line, it's all about feeling safe to be uncomfortable or something like that.
Yeah.
And we snipped it, and it's in the intro to the podcast, because just loved it.
Yeah.
And that for me is, kind of in a nutshell, it's having these uncomfortable conversations to go, I'm not comfortable with that. I understand you coming from a very different position to me, and I'm ready for you to tell me that you're not comfortable with me being uncomfortable with it, in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, and I love that you brought up power as well, because people in power, whether that's, you know, whether they own the business, they run the business, they're CEO, they've got, you know, they're higher up in the hierarchy, or they've just been with the business a long time, like they've got loads of tenure, and you know everyone knows old Bob, he's been with us 3 decades, yeah. And you know, so old Bob has a lot of power in a certain sense of the word. Or there might be there's lots of different kinds of, there's many, many dimensions of power. And so it's really important for us to acknowledge that. You know, it's the same as privilege. Privilege and power are kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
I do believe it is beholden upon those with most power, the most privilege, to put in maybe more effort to create these safe spaces. What's interesting is that it can often be, in a sense, more uncomfortable for them to do so, because they're not used to being challenged. They're not used to people speaking up to challenge their ideas, the way they behave, the way they do things. And mm-hmm. So that can be really uncomfortable, particularly if you're a leader who, say, owns a business, who's been doing it, it's their own business, they've been doing it for 20, 30, 40 years, to suddenly try and create a space where everyone can tell them they're doing it wrong or they need to change something. Really, yeah. Really uncomfortable.
And also, like, just kind of since becoming one and also then working with loads of them, I just feel sorry for managing directors and CEOs and senior leaders in organizations, man. Like, there is so much to think about. And I've raised this in a few conversations in the new viewy type of safety world, in an art which I include myself in, that in that we are so good now at not blaming the shop floor, but we are terrible at not blaming leaders. Like, we blame leaders like mad.
Yeah.
And we do not apply the same principles of local rationality, considering the context, all of that. We do not apply that to leadership whatsoever. If you're a managing director and you've killed someone, you're a bad person. Even though, do you know what, most managing directors I know would be suicidal if they killed someone in their workplace. They would be so distraught.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. We do have this slightly strange paradigm, and where on one hand leaders are kind of exalted and these kind of like supreme beings, in this sort of maybe the Simon Sinek kind of world, where they're kind of and then there's a sort of another paradigm almost at the same time, where they're the kind of that everything is on the leader, everything is their fault, everything is their responsibility, and if something goes wrong, it's on them. And to a degree, both are true.
It is on them, 100%. They have the power. Yeah. It is on them, and this is where I'm conscious of the time. We need to wrap this up and move this onto the end of it, because I've got another call coming up. But ultimately, it is on them. But that's where I think this conversation of accountability is really interesting. Yeah. In that we're not removing accountability. You're still accountable. You could still be legally held to account. And so you should.
Yeah.
And so should the employee as well. But ultimately, we can still consider the context. Yeah. I do think that is what a court of law does. If we look at a court of law, that's what a jury does. That's what a judge does. You go, it's got two opposition and prosecution and defense. Tell us the context. Right, now I'm going to make a decision based off that context.
Yeah.
I think the judicial system has been doing it pretty well for a very long time.
Yeah, and it's always messy. Like, it's always messy.
Yeah.
Everything is messy because we're people. We're biological, crazy beings.
Emotional,
irrational, and so it's always going to be messy. There's always going to be extra reasons, extra things we didn't think of, the messy details of that we can get into in conversations about why something went wrong, how it went wrong. Yeah. Yeah. It's never clear cut.
Well,
it's always contextual. Yeah,
Tom, I could stand and talk to you about this pretty much all day.
yeah,
and it's been quite refreshing actually talking to you, because I kind of have become exhausted with it all. Of like, I find LinkedIn a very toxic platform, if I'm honest, but seeing it on LinkedIn a lot of times, I'm just like, oh God, I've had enough of this. So talking to you has kind of rejuvenated my passion for a lot of this stuff. So thank you very much.
Oh, good, good. I'm really pleased about that. Yeah, and the same. It's it can be hard to not be worn down by some of the less than ideal messaging.
Yeah. So we weren't 100% sure what we were going to talk about in the last episode. So we were going to ask the listeners for some feedback. If they've got any questions, let us know. You when this comes out, you have like a good month until the next one comes out. So if you, in the first 2 or 3 weeks of that month, get us some questions, you should work out that we'll have that in time for us doing the recording. However, In addition to that, there are two things we were going to discuss today, which we have not got onto, which is the criticisms and the relationship with Workers Done Workers Imagine. So I think what we'll do, last episode, we'll talk about criticism, Workers Done Workers Imagine. And if listeners do send us some questions, we will slot them in as well. And if listeners don't send us any questions, I'll make some up so that it looks like we've got a really engaged audience.
Good move. I like it. Yeah. Excellent.
And now I've told you that, you'll never know. You'll never know. Okay, Tom, if people love what you're talking about and they want to find out more about you, work with you, whatever, how can they get in touch with you?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, good point. So yeah, head over to psychsafety.com. And sign up to the newsletter, get in touch, read some of the articles. We're nearly at newsletter 100 now, so there's quite a lot to get through on the website, because they're all there to read through. So if you want to get stuck into this stuff, yeah, get over there and find out more, and yeah, get in touch. There's also a community to get signed up to and involved in. There's meetups and all sorts of stuff, so yeah.
Awesome. And your download, I think it's either free or very cheap. I can't remember.
It's it's relatively cheap. It's £17.50 to download the Psychological Safety Action Pack, which is like a toolkit full of loads and loads of stuff to build and measure and learn about psychological safety with your teams and in an organization. So yeah.
That's really good. I downloaded that. I love it. It's really good. I like that. And yet your newsletter is very good as well. I quite like yours and Chris Clearfield's is probably the only ones I actually read at the moment. No offense if anyone else says we don't do that. Thank you very much, Tom. And I hope, thank you very much. It's been a good chat. I really enjoyed
it. Thank you, James. Really appreciate it. I've had a great time.
Okay, peeps, hope you enjoyed that episode 2 of Psychological Safety. If you need some help with this stuff, obviously go check out Tom if you're looking for specialist psychological safety stuff. Tom is 100% where to go. Me and Tom actually do some work together as well, where our customers are looking for a combination of kind of taking high reliability, human organizational performance, risk management stuff, applying it to a safety kind of focus area. But psychological safety tends to fall quite close within that. So if we ever need some real specialist work on psychological safety, we bring Tom in. He's that good. So go check out Tom. Obviously, if you need some help with safety, risk management, fire safety, you want your safety systems, safety management, safety approach, safety culture, all to be a bit more like high reliability, that is what we do. So check out riskfluentltd.com and we can help you out. We're just doing some awesome projects at the moment, all focused around learning organizations and human-centered risk management and safety. It's proper exciting stuff. We're mad with fire safety stuff as well, as we said on the last podcast as well. It's all fire at the minute. So if you need some help, you need a chat, whatever, you want to come on the podcast, drop me a line, james@riskfluentltd.com, or you can go on our website, there's a contact us page, and you can just put whatever you want in there. Catch you next week. Safe.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and its guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of the companies. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are examples only based on limited and dated open source information and should not be utilised in real life as the only solution available. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the companies. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic or otherwise, without prior written permission from James McPherson.